and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. A. Philip Randolph became president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters in 1925. Before then, he was active in the Socialist Party, which, because of its focus on class and capitalism, didn't tend to attract black radicals who thought, wrote, and organized around issues of race. So what did Randolph see in the Socialist Project? How did socialists and communists engage, or not, with issues of racial justice and emancipation? And why did A. Philip Randolph develop a staunch anti-communism? Addressing these questions requires examining key social and political currents in 20th century America, and also grasping Randolph's relationship to figures like Eugene Debs and W.E.B. Du Bois. Eric Arneson has for many years examined and investigated Randolph's thought and activism. One of his books is Brotherhoods of Color, Black Railroad Workers and the Struggle for Equality. He also recently contributed an essay to the new book Reframing Randolph, edited by Andrew Kirsten and Clarence Lang. Eric Arneson is professor of history at the George Washington University. When he joined me, I asked him what the young Asa Philip Randolph learned from his parents.
Randolph, later in life, spoke before audiences and gave oral histories in which he reflected back on his early years. And he spoke a great deal about his parents, and he did indeed say that he had gotten several key fundamentals from his mother and his father. And Randolph and his brother absorbed what he called an abiding passion for reading and learning and intellectual engagement that infused their childhood through their teenage years. That was part one. And part two was a deep and abiding interest in politics and commitment to political action and political change. His father was an AME minister, and in that capacity, he tended to souls. He preached to congregations in Jacksonville, Florida, and in rural Florida in small communities. But he was also part of a tradition within the AME church, a tradition that fused the saving of souls and the change in the here and now of conditions that were unjust. And from the Reconstruction era through the early 20th century, the AME church, like many African American churches, provided a base for political action, for resistance to racial injustice and the like. And Randolph was part and parcel of that world, absorbing from his father the religious tenets and these political commitments. Growing up, the emphasis on education, there were books in the household, no matter how poor that the family was, the commitment to education and the commitment to politics. These are things that he invoked later in life as setting him on a course toward socialism and political change. It may not have been that simple a path or trajectory, but I do think these constituted resources that he could draw upon later in his life.
AME being African Methodist Episcopal. And Randolph was also, I understand, encouraged to develop a sense of racial pride and self-confidence.
Absolutely. His parents were poor, but race pride was foundational in the family. Randolph grew up never believing that he was inferior to any white person, even though Jim Crow Florida in this particular era in the 1890s. The races were segregated by law increasingly. African Americans were increasingly deprived of the vote, and racial violence directed against African Americans was abounding across the state and even in his community. But you know, through the materials that he read, through the church environment that he was a part of, you know, he saw a train of bishops and religious leaders coming forward, holding forth, preaching a gospel of black community solidarity, of racial pride. This gave him role models. And between the sermons and talks that he heard and the things that he read and what his father and mother talked to him about growing up, he also had a sense of history and African American history in particular. Now, we only have this from his recollections later in life, but the way he tells the story time and time again, he grew up hearing about black abolitionists, or rather abolitionists black and white. He grew up hearing about slave insurrections. Nat Turner was a name discussed around the dinner table. He grew up hearing about the black politicians during the era of Reconstruction who strove to represent African Americans in that tumultuous period in American history during the transition from slavery to freedom. So race, race consciousness, African-American history, traditions of black politics and resistance, these were things that he absorbed through what he read, through the sermons and talks that he heard, from the dinner table conversations, from simply growing up in the Randolph household.
I want to jump ahead to when Randolph moved to New York City in 1911. He was 22 years old. Did he find the racial situation in New York City dramatically different than the one he grew up in Florida?
There's a yes and no answer to that question. Undoubtedly, the North was not the South. While never free of racial violence, there was simply a lot less of it. And to hear his stories about how he navigated the streets of the city, took classes at City College of New York in the evenings, wandered about Harlem, taking in theatrical productions, going to street corner speeches and speeches in union halls, these were things he could not do to the same degree at all growing up in Jacksonville, Florida. So there was a freedom or liberty of movement that he gained in New York that he didn't have in Jacksonville. And he was exposed to a much wider political, social, recreational environment than he had growing up in Florida as well. And so New York, in many ways, was something of a liberation for him, both personally and intellectually. At the same time, while the North is not the South, it's not paradise or the promised land either. The North may not have barred African Americans from voting, but try to get a job, as countless young African American men and women tried to do in this era, and they would find themselves confined to the lowest rungs on the economic ladder. Common labor, work on the docks, carrying things back and forth, heavy labor, messenger boys, elevator operators. They were confined to service, domestic, and common laborer for the most part. So Randolph, like a generation of migrants to New York City, found himself kind of locked out of better jobs and found himself simply kind of moving about the lower ends of the economy. And this had profound influence and impact on black migrants who were not able to hold jobs for long, were not able to acquire much by the way of wages or certainly invest in property. It was tough going. So the North, very different from the South, but by no means, under any circumstances, could it be seen as the promised land.
So he moves to New York in 1911. In 1912, he enrolls in night classes at City College, then among, quote, the hottest beds of radicalism in New York City, as Randolph put it. Tell me about his exposure to socialist ideas and socialist thinkers at that time.
That exposure came both from the classroom of the university and the classroom of the streets. In the university, he rubbed shoulders with a wide range of students and professors, some of whom he remembered quite fondly for their deep commitment to challenging their students, to push their thinking. He was certainly exposed to the history of the working class and currents in European socialism in the classroom. But then there was the education of the streets, the classroom that was New York itself. And this is an era in which New York's very large and largely immigrant working class was not sitting idly by accepting exploitative working conditions. It was organizing. It was organizing in large numbers. And so trade unionism was widespread in the city of New York. in immigrant communities and not. And socialism took root across the city, anchored in these immigrant communities, but not confined to them. The city had a vibrant socialist party. It had vibrant chapters of immigrant radicals, the Yiddish locals, Finnish locals, and so forth and so on. And Randolph mingled. He went through the crowds. He heard people speaking on soapboxes. He heard people in Union and other halls preaching the gospel of socialism. And it was one that he increasingly found attractive over the next couple of years.
Eric Arneson is his name. He's a professor of history at the George Washington University. He's author of Brotherhoods of Color, Black Railroad Workers and the Struggle for Equality, and Black Protest and the Great Migration. And his article about A. Philip Randolph, Emerging Socialist Radical, appears in the volume Reframing Randolph, Labor, Black Freedom, and the Legacies of A. Philip Randolph. So Randolph joins the Socialist Party in 1917. And before we talk about his reasons for doing so, how was that party doing by the time that Randolph joined it?
In 1917, the party was doing pretty well. Ask that question of a few years later, we'll have a different answer. But in 1917, if you lived in a New York immigrant community, the party is a physical, palpable presence. The ideas resonate in newspapers, on street corners, in union halls. The party puts forward political candidates for local office, and they often win. So there's actually an electoral presence of socialists on the political scene. They run in the campaign of 1916 for president. They contest the mayoral election. Morris Hillquit runs in 1917. And they are a force to be contended with. Now, they don't carry the mayor's race, but they command attention. They command tremendous support amongst trade unionists and immigrant radicals. There's every reason to believe that socialism is on the ascent and that the electoral path that the party is pursuing is bearing fruit and will continue to bear fruit. That was the case when Randolph joined in 1916, 1917, and that held for at least a few more years to come.
So the Socialist Party advocates for workers. There are a lot of black workers. To what extent did the party appeal to specifically African Americans?
Before Randolph joined the party, I think the answer is, well, not very much. There had been a number, not a large number, a very small number of black socialists prior to this point. Hubert Harrison, for example, was a leading African-American intellectual in New York who affiliated and worked for the Socialist Party around 1911, 1912. He came to sour on the Socialist Party, both because its electoral path didn't seem to him particularly compelling for African-American workers, but also because he thought the party was simply doing too little to attract black support. And that critique and that picture of the party being tone deaf, if you will, to black aspirations and black needs, and that picture of the party not reaching out to African-American workers is one that has endured in a good part of the literature that historians and others have generated over the years.
Well, was Harrison right? I mean, did the Socialist Party leadership tend to ignore blacks and their struggles?
This is my second yes and no answer to a question that you're posing. On one level, yup, absolutely. The party in New York is a largely immigrant party. And immigrants, in some cases, flock to its banner. The party is not exactly going out organizing constituencies. Those constituencies are drawn to the party. That's not the case for African Americans. So is it true that the party is not actively recruiting? That's right. Harrison was not wrong in making that charge. Now, when Randolph comes along with his colleague Chandler Owen in 1916, 1917, The local socialists are delighted and take great interest in Randolph and the interest that he takes in what they are doing. They support Randolph. Randolph wants to start a magazine. They provide financial support through one of the garment workers' unions and the Socialist Party as well. They don't see this as a contradiction. They don't see this as a reverse in policy. Here is someone who is actively putting forth socialist ideas, in this case, speaking for and to Black New Yorkers and Black Americans generally. Terrific, they say. How can we help? Let's give support. And in the handful of years after that, 1917 through the early 1920s, there is a small but solid, very vocal and very active Black socialist operation in Harlem, the 21st Assembly District branch of the Socialist Party. The Socialist Party nominates African Americans for office. Randolph runs for office, a number of offices in the late teens and early 20s. His wife, Lucille Green Randolph, advanced as a socialist candidate for alderman in 1923. Frank Crosswaith, a Caribbean immigrant to New York, devoted socialist, he too runs for political office. The New York Call, the socialist daily newspaper, covers civil rights issues, issues of white violence against African Americans on a fairly regular basis, and frankly is kinder to the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, a decidedly not socialist group, than Randolph and Owen are in their papers. So, you know, on the one hand, the party is not actively organizing African-American workers, but as I note in the longer manuscript that I'm writing, it didn't exactly organize many people at all. The constituencies came to the party. The party supported Randolph and Owen financially, morally, politically. They repaid that support by advancing socialist ideas in the Black community. Someone like Eugene V. Debs, just to give an example. At one point in the early 20th century, he uttered the words, something to the effect of, the Socialist Party has nothing special to offer the Negro. And by this, he meant that the Socialist Party was a working class party. And insofar as African Americans were predominantly working class, of course the Socialist Party would be the party of African Americans, but not because of their race, but because of their class status. And that phrase has often been pulled out and used to say, ah, the socialists didn't get it on race. They did nothing for Black members. When the communists break away in 1919 through the early 1920s, you know, it's in part because the Socialist Party is so unreceptive to Black needs. A number of years ago, an historian at the University of Wisconsin, Will Jones, did an absolutely terrific article revisiting that Debs early speech and made a very persuasive case that this did not mean in Debs's minds that socialists had no interest in Blacks, but that he was just phrasing it a particular way. And if you fast forward to the World War I years, Debs at one point engages in a kind of in-print debate with W.E.B. Du Bois, who is the editor of the NAACP's magazine, The Crisis. And Debs's words are absolutely powerful. It is rare to hear any white American in this era speak with as much passion and commitment to civil rights and the Black struggle, and in his condemnation of the history of race in American, in the American past. He's absolutely scathing in his critique of the slave trade, in the outcome of the Civil War, in the denial of civil and economic liberties to African American workers. This is a very powerful speech. And it's that message that Randolph hears. And as I read his various writings and his various speeches, it doesn't really occur to him that the party is an inhospitable place. He likes what he hears. In 1923, Randolph, his wife Lucille, Frank Crosswaith, and Debs share a stage in Harlem, in which Debs endorses Lucille Randolph's bid for elective office. She does not win, but it is an absolutely powerful speech that he delivers on the Negro workers. I have no doubt understanding why Randolph had such affection for Debs and the party that he was a part of.
So if A. Philip Randolph, in some sense, ignored what other black radicals and black progressives were saying, that the Socialist Party was too class-focused and didn't make race as central as they wanted, then what did he, in, especially in the journal that he co-founded and co-edited, The Messenger, what kind of pitch did he make to black readers? How did he frame the appeal of the Socialist Party to people who he was very much hoping would join the socialist cause?
That's an excellent question. And Randolph addressed his African-American readership with a number of arguments. When it came to selling or advertising the Socialist Party to black voters, vote for the Socialist Party, he would say, he put forth a number of arguments. First, that the two major parties in the United States had completely and utterly abandoned African Americans if they had ever had their interests at heart. The Democrats, there's nothing nice to say about them. This is the party of slavery, the party of the Civil War, the party of white reaction, the party of Jim Crow, the party of lynching, race riots, and other forms of violence against African Americans. So, never mind the Democrats. The Republicans had long had an electoral lock on the black vote and on black political loyalties. This reached back to the Civil War era when the Republican Party was in power, oversaw the war against the Confederacy, ushered in a variety of amendments and laws designed to, at least for a brief moment, help African Americans. It was the bloody flag. It was the party that freed the slaves. And over the years, enough, and that's not a lot, but enough African-American politicos received patronage jobs and support from the Republicans to retain their loyalty, and they in turn pitched the Republicans to the broader black electorate. Now, by the turn of the 20th century, the Republicans didn't have much to go on other than that legacy, because what they were doing for African Americans at that moment was really not very much. It did not staunchly oppose lynching and disfranchisement in the South. It might wag its finger, but did nothing more than that. And Randolph and Chandler Owen and others in the pages of The Messenger said, "What has the Republican Party done for us lately? Nothing." And what you get are the black political class, and they had some very descriptive, very colorful, and very derogatory words that they used to describe them, the hat in hand Negroes, who lick the boots of the Republican masters, who do their bidding in exchange for a patronage slot here, a slot there. But ultimately, any agenda touching upon civil rights or the protection of black lives and liberties, you couldn't find this in Republican ranks at that point. So blacks never were assisted by the Democrats, only hurt. The Republicans had long stopped offering any substantive assistance. So where did that leave the black voters? As long as they continue to support the Republican Party, they would be taken for granted.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Eric Arneson joins us. He teaches history at the George Washington University. He's editor of The Black Worker, Race, Labor, and Civil Rights Since Emancipation, and also the editor of The Encyclopedia of U.S. Labor and Working Class History. He joins us to talk about his research into A. Philip Randolph, much of which is encapsulated in an article he wrote for the new volume, Reframing Randolph. We have a link to that book, to Eric's faculty page at the George Washington University, and to more of his work on our website, againstthegrain.org. Okay, so Randolph, he is telling his readers, he's telling any African Americans who listen to, who will listen to him or read him, that the Republicans and Democrats are not an option. They are hostile to blacks in the United States. So what does he say affirmatively in terms of what the Socialist Party to which he belonged could offer?
He puts forth a standard socialist refrain that African Americans, as workers, as members of the working class, will best be served by the party of the working class, the Socialist Party. Rents in Harlem are too high. Which political party will fight to bring rents down? Not the Democrats, not the Republicans, but the socialists. Who's going to fight for higher wages? Not the Democrats or Republicans, but the socialists. Who will clean up corruption? Who will provide social welfare benefits for New York City's workers? It's the socialists. So time and again, he comes back to the economic argument that the Socialist Party's program is a party that will benefit African Americans generally because they are workers. Now, he doesn't infuse those articles to a large extent with the argument that the Socialist Party will carry the banner of civil rights forward. It's as if there's a split personality in his writings and in the journal. And he, in different pieces, will make the case for black self-organization, for the need to resist racial violence with force if necessary, strike back against the lynchers, fight for all of these changes. And yes, the Socialist Party will be supportive, but black self-organization too is absolutely central to that mission.
My understanding is that A. Philip Randolph first read the work of the sociologist, historian, and writer W.E.B. Du Bois as a teenager, and he was rather drawn to what Du Bois was writing. How did Randolph respond to Du Bois's ideas as his political intellectual maturity process proceeded?
I'm not sure I believe Randolph when he talks about reading Du Bois and being so impressed by him when he was a youth growing up in Jacksonville. Maybe it happened, maybe it didn't. This was something that he reported many, many decades later, and in his later years. Perhaps it was true, perhaps this was a misrecollection. I can't speak to that. He says it, so maybe it's true. But if he did read Du Bois, and if he was impressed with him in Jacksonville, he lost that admiration when he got to New York. And being immersed in socialist circles meant that Randolph was very much to the left of Du Bois and came to see Du Bois as a centrist who did not understand the central issues of the times and was putting forth a set of policies that were not designed to actually help black Americans. Randolph and Owen took on the existing black leadership with a vengeance. And to black conservatives like Booker T. Washington, Robert Moton, and others, they were scathing in their language and in the depth and passion of their critique. Du Bois fell into that category. Okay, he's not a Booker T. Washington, he's not an accommodationist, but he's not a socialist either. And time and again, they find fault with Du Bois for not going far enough, for putting forth what Du Bois claims to be a scientific explanation. And the young Chandler Owen and A. Philip Randolph would say, what scientific explanation? The great sociologist doesn't know his sociology, doesn't know that the great revolutions of our time are revolutions that will involve the redistribution of property and the uprising of oppressed peoples across racial lines. So they have it in for Du Bois. They treat him very roughly in the pages of The Messenger, and they don't let up for years. They rag on the guy well into the 1920s. Even as they change their thinking about other black leaders and make their peace with the NAACP, they still, I think, resent Du Bois's prominence as kind of the leading black spokesperson for kind of the non-conservatives. You know, that's a role that they want to claim for themselves. Now, later, when the messenger folds, when Randolph is working for the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, and he has real obligations, not journalistic obligations, but real obligations to the porters in his union, he needs allies. And he turns down the volume on some of the critique that he has been articulating. Du Bois is an important and prominent Black leader. They kind of need him on board, and they gesture and they reach out to Du Bois for his support for the Pullman porters, and in so doing, they cut back, you know, on the critique.
If the focus of the Socialist Party critique was capitalism, that was the target, how did A. Philip Randolph see race and racial prejudice and racism operating under capitalism?
It is a mistake, I think, as many people have argued, to think this through too theoretically. There's a tendency to think of, you know, Marxism as a philosophical system that prioritizes certain categories. And yes, you know, that's true on one level. But on the ground, in practice, Randolph was not a particularly original or, I would say, deep theoretical thinker. He was a terrific writer, and I find reading his pieces moving, powerful, intriguing. But if you're looking for some way of kind of synthesizing a critique of race and class in a single model, keep looking, I would say. What Randolph and many socialists saw was race and racial divisions as tools that the employing class, the ruling class, whatever you want to call it, used to separate workers from one another. Whip them up into a frenzy, tell white workers that they are superior, pit whites against blacks. That way they are divided, the better to exploit them and to reap the riches that they are producing. So racial tension, racism, then becomes a function of capitalism and the employing class in whose interest it is to further the racial divide. And the Socialist Party, because it is the party of the working class with no divisions of race or ethnicity or creed in its vision, would work to overcome that. And workers, Randolph and other socialists would say in a fairly straightforward manner, have all the interests in common, ought not to be divided by race, and someday, somehow, we'll wake up to this fact and we'll rise up and put an end to these kinds of divisions. Not very sophisticated. But I have to say, in much left thought, it doesn't get all that much more sophisticated than the original socialist divide and conquer view. But having said that, Randolph also simultaneously wrote extensively about race, about racial oppression, about racial violence, about the specific ways in which white Southerners, white Northerners, employers, white unions oppressed African Americans. And he called on blacks to organize, organize, organize. And so in those pieces, while you never forgot that he was a socialist, you saw a very different side of him. And both of those pictures of, you know, racism as divide and conquer, we must unify the working class and overcome our oppression on the one hand, and African Americans are being crushed by, you name the group, they're doing it, and we must organize jointly to fight back against oppression wherever we may find it. These things coexist side by side.
Eric Arneson, A-R-N-E-S-E-N, history professor at the George Washington University. We'll take a short break and speak more with Eric about his research into A. Philip Randolph and the radical environments in the first half of the 20th century. Please stay with us. Thank you. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Eric Arneson is a professor of history at the George Washington University. His books include Black Protest and the Great Migration and Brotherhoods of Color, Black Railroad Workers and the Struggle for Equality. He wrote an article about A. Philip Randolph that appears in the new volume Reframing Randolph, Labor, Black Freedom, and the Legacies of A. Philip Randolph. It's published by NYU Press. Now, in this article, you write that Randolph would eventually become one of the most prominent left-wing anti-communists in the nation, in the U.S. And so my sense is that a lot of people conflate socialism with communism and the Socialist Party, let's say in the early 20th century, with the Communist Party. Tell us about the stance that Randolph took vis-a-vis the Communist Party and how the Communist Party grouping differed from the Socialist Party in its emphasis and its agenda.
The Communist Party's origins come out of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia and the new Soviet Union during and after the Great War in the teens. And there were many socialists who were genuinely excited and deeply enthusiastic about the overthrow of the Tsar and the arrival of a new social order. Some socialists began to cool on that when they saw what that new regime looked like, the ways in which civil liberties and civil rights were sacrificed in the name of the all-powerful party. Others stuck with that model, and they said, look, the Soviets pulled it off. The Bolsheviks pulled it off. They know what they are doing. We will look to them for guidance for a path forward. And in essence, in 1919, a breakaway number of socialists form a variety of communist parties, and they reject the evolutionary model that the socialists had been following. Elections, that'll get you nowhere. The Bolsheviks, the seizure of state power by force, and the ushering in of the dictatorship of the proletariat, now that's a model, they said. Now, Randolph appeared on the stage with many of these people in 1919, even into 1920, and he too threw around the word Bolshevik. His critics, the socialist critics, called them all Bolsheviks. Randolph would wave the word back at them. Of course we're all Bolsheviks. But he wasn't. And with the split in the party, Randolph stays with those who pursue the electoral path, the path of evolutionary socialism. And he is genuinely committed, and he believes that every reform of capitalism will somehow remove a brick from the wall that will eventually lead to its collapse and the ushering in of a new and better day. The Bolsheviks reject that model. Now, in the black community, a number of black socialists vote with their feet and join the new communist forces. They're small in number. They're vocal. They don't like the socialists at all. Randolph doesn't have much to say about them for the first couple of years in the early 20s. But by 1922 and 1923, he begins to voice his critique. And he finds them wrongly taking their instructions from Moscow. What does Moscow know about the condition of the American Negro, he would say. He begins to make fun of the ways in which they roll their R's with the word revolution. And there's a kind of a contempt as well as a rejection of the tenets of the party. He remains a democratic socialist, and he has no fondness for the Bolshevik model. Fast forward. In the late 1930s, he makes allies with communists, as do many American progressives, during the Popular Front period. When the Stalin-Hitler Pact is signed in 1939, a great deal changes. And at that moment, Randolph, who never accepted the communist vision and really didn't like their way of doing things, broke with them for the last time and essentially declared his own personal war against the party. He worked with communists in creating the National Negro Congress, a grassroots organization in the late 1930s. It was inspired by anti-racism and anti-fascism. But what happens in 39? The communists throw anti-fascism out the window. And almost overnight, they attempt to change the National Negro Congress and other institutions into anti-war vehicles. This is about stopping the new imperialist war that is about to draw the United States in, that's breaking out in Europe and then in Asia. And Randolph is absolutely opposed to this. He preaches against the communist doctrine. He preaches against the communist methods of organizing. He preaches against the ways in which they change their party line. You snap your fingers, Moscow snaps its fingers, everything changes. The communists, in his eyes, become a menace. They, in effect, as he sees it, destroy the National Negro Congress. And that was unforgivable. And in the years ahead, Randolph remains at war with the communists, who, by the way, remain at war with Randolph, because Randolph becomes the big defender of the war. He is not a peace-loving man. They reject everything and anything he has to say. So the acrimony flows both ways. But I argue elsewhere that Randolph's deeply felt anti-communism was born both of his practical experiences with the American communists and his ideological differences, which were stark with the practice and doctrine that the communists put forward.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Eric Arneson is my guest via the Flash Studio at the George Washington University, where Eric teaches history. So you write, and it is a fact, that by the early 1920s, radical movements had begun to go into decline, and that A. Philip Randolph knew this. What did he have to say about both the decline of the left and the causes of that decline?
It's not just the decline of the left. One could say that it's the decline of various kinds of popular insurgencies. So the labor movement expanded dramatically during the First World War. It is crushed in a series of strikes, titanic strikes, small strikes in the immediate war's aftermath. The NAACP, this is not widely recognized, but also experienced substantial membership growth during the war. It, too, is largely crushed in the war's aftermath. The Garvey movement rises. The Garvey movement falls. The socialist movement splits. In 1919, it itself has suffered tremendous government repression. So between the government coming down hard on it and the splits, it is a much smaller version of itself. And as the years move on in the early 1920s, the party fares poorly at the polls. And so by 1923, 1924, Randolph, I wouldn't say is disillusioned, but he just has less to say about the Socialist Party. And by the time the Socialists in the presidential campaign of 1924, for example, throws its lot in with a broader coalition of progressives mobilizing behind La Follette, he's, I wouldn't say ambivalent, but he's certainly not enthusiastic. And that's the moment in which even many socialists realize that the game is up, or that their moment has passed, that they're faring terribly at the polls. Their numbers are in decline. The labor movement's in decline. And Randolph seems, to my mind, somewhat depressed. This is not a psychological assessment. I'm reading his writings, and there's a sense of kind of desperation and despair when he writes about the world situation or the prospect for progressive politics in the United States. So, you know, he doesn't go out with a bang. It's not even a whimper, but it's a kind of a gradual recognition that the vehicle that he has invested so much hope and faith in, the Socialist Party, isn't producing much by way of results for anybody, African Americans or whites. So he continues to edit his magazine, and then...
And then the organizers of the new Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters sought out A. Philip Randolph, who became the organization's president in 1925. Did this represent a shift in Randolph's political focus toward a trade union labor kind of focus?
In terms of the amount of time that he spent on the subject, absolutely. In terms of how he saw social change taking place, no. From his earliest writings in The Messenger in 1917, 18, 19, he and Chandler Owen and the other writers in the paper are very interested in working class issues and in trade unionism and in the organization of black workers at the point of production in particular. They critique the AFL, the American Federation of Labor, for its exclusionary racial practices. They heap tremendous praise on the Industrial Workers of the World, the industrial union group that champions radical change and admits African American workers enthusiastically into their ranks. They work with small groups of New York black workers, elevator operators, for example, in the early 1920s. So labor is on his mind. It is a crucial component of his socialist vision. He is looking for positive examples, and he finds it in the IWW, which itself is in decline. So when the offer from the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters comes in the summer of 1925, there's everything to suggest that, he would be ready for this moment, that this fits in with his larger vision of social change, of black working class activism, of promoting interracial trade unionism. And the offer comes, he takes the job, and instantly his energy shift. He throws himself into this organizing effort with, I think, a passion that we haven't seen before, and this becomes his life. This becomes his all-consuming mission for the next 10 years until the Brotherhood wins its union election in 1935, and then in 1937, it wins its first contract with the Pullman Company. So this is, in a certain sense, kind of a culmination, an imperfect culmination of his commitment to a working-class politics and black trade unionism that was evidenced in his writings and speeches before that point.
You write that his efforts with the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, quote, transformed black activism. How so?
Randolph brought the gospel of trade unionism into black communities. Before 1925, yes, there had been traditions of black trade unionism, but most newspaper editors of the black press, most ministers, most black leaders were hostile or cool to the idea of black trade unionism. This dates back to earlier years when Booker T. Washington and others suggested that black workers had to make themselves useful to white employers. And what better way to make oneself useful than to reject trade unionism like those pesky whites were embracing, and to work hard and to earn the loyalty of white employers. And indeed, trade unions did not have a great record with regard to openness toward African Americans and other minority workers. And employers, despite the color bar that kept workers out of higher positions, did have jobs to distribute. So up until the mid-20s, much of the established black leadership was not keen on blacks joining trade unions. Over that next decade, Randolph preaches, and I think that's the right verb there, preaches this gospel of black trade unionism, brings it into black communities, wins over black ministers, wins over black community leaders and editors, so that by the time the Great Depression hits, by the time the new organizing waves occur, the black community is both familiar with trade unionism and the reasons why black workers should organize, and they are more receptive to overtures from organized labor to include them in their ranks. And along the way, Randolph and the Brotherhood, he does not do this alone. This is not a solo act. They spearhead a new kind of grassroots politics. This is not a politics where they go to politicians or city leaders and say, please, in exchange for our votes, may we have. They're demanding. They don't always get. They often don't get. But they're demanding, and they're mobilizing, and they're marching, and they're holding conferences and parades and rallies and demonstrations. And in so doing, they shift kind of the center of black political activity in a more activist direction. They don't do it alone. There are others who are engaged in this process, but they are a key part of spurring on black trade unionism and a more militant grassroots orientation in civil rights groups over the course of the late 20s through the 1930s and 40s.
And beyond being, you know, a thinker and a writer, A. Philip Randolph was an orator as well. He spoke in Harlem on some of these soapboxes. How good of a speaker was he?
By all accounts, he was terrific. Randolph, in his teenage years and in his early 20s, had a hope that he might actually go into the theater. And he performed in amateur theatrical productions. He did readings of Shakespeare with his wife. He very much saw the stage as a place where he could perform. His parents weren't so keen on the idea of his becoming an actor. This was not considered reputable or acceptable in a religious household. So he turns to socialism instead, a subject over which I guess his parents didn't have much say. And those oratorical abilities that he refined in debating groups in college, in groups that he formed, in the theater groups that he participated in, prepared him quite well, as did, I think, listening to his father's preaching and the preaching of other AME ministers growing up, gave his speech a certain dramatic flair. Speakers later on, you know, talked about, you know, kind of the Shakespearean lilt in what he was saying. Some thought he was Harvard educated, but that elocution lessons that he had taken and his theatrical productions and listening to his religious father, I think all made for a very powerful speaking style that held audiences spellbound for decades.
Eric Arneson, he is a professor of history at the George Washington University. You can check out his article, A. Philip Randolph, Emerging Socialist Radical, which is part of the new volume, Reframing Randolph. And or you may want to pick up his books, Brotherhoods of Color, Black Railroad Workers and the Struggle for Equality, and Black Protest and the Great Migration. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time.